This is Indexed.
Welcome, everyone, to Indexed, the podcast where we dive into a band's discography and rank it, while touching on their history, influences, and their place in the musical pantheon along the way. I'm your host, Mike Scarpelli, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Buehler. Today's episode is IDX 40.0, and we'll be indexing the discography of Tears for Fears. Welcome back to Index, everybody. Last episode of season four. So we're 40 episodes in now.
Dude, it's been 40?
I know. Well, that's not in counting. I guess we've only done the one mini episode, so, or the teasers. So, yeah. But still, four full episodes, four full seasons.
We're over the hill now.
Mm-hmm. I know we kind of, or I might have teased out this one a little heavy at the end of the last episode, but you know, I'm like, oh yeah, we could talk about this one for hours and hours, but in reality, we're not going to do that just because we learned our lesson after the first episode that we ever did. And it was like almost 2 hours. Like, that's too long.
Oh yeah.
We'll make this a tight, you know, hour ish, probably with seven albums, with how efficient we are now. So won't take up too much of your day. Yeah. Okay.
We know you enjoy being here with us.
Yes. So. Yes. It's not like a struggle to get through and listen to us talk about this stuff.
I know their first album's a little sad, but we don't have to take that tone.
Yeah. No, we'll get into that for sure in the album talk. But yeah, so we're talking Tears for Fears. Formed all the way back in 1981 in Bath, England. Seems to be a good, not Bath itself, but England seems to be a decent well for us across our 40 episodes. And it just says who we are is like music listeners or what we enjoy, but oh man.
I mean, the imperialists. So a lot of things started there and branched out. So you have the
true,
but I think it's the island thing too. So, I mean, they're right there, but you always get concentrations of culture and all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah, so they're formed in the 80s. They are like a synth pop, rock, new wave-ish kind of band. They definitely, I think if you ask most people that have heard of the band, I'd say most people have heard of this band. I think most people think they peaked in the early 80s or whatever, because they did kind of vanish for a while. And so basically like, well, not necessarily vanish, I guess. They just kind of lost their popularity with the music listeners as a whole, maybe.
Yeah. And I know this is not a visual medium, but there's Tears for Fears, and then there's Tears for Fears. I'm air quoting here. Yes. And then we're back to Tears for Fears.
Correct. Yeah, we can lay out that timeline for you right now, I guess. So basically, the two core members of the band are Roland Orzabal. He's the guitarist. He's mainly the lead vocalist. He shares it's like a lead backing vocal duty sharing with Kurt Smith, who's the bassist. So Kurt originally left in 1991. So at that point, that's when it becomes, air quotes, Tears for Fears, basically a Roland solo deal, but he kept the name. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up joining back with Roland in 2000, basically because they had to settle some estate paperwork thing or something like that. Basically, they had to get, like, Roland had to get a signature from Kurt for something. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, oh, well, I guess I don't hate you as much anymore now, so...
We're a little older now. It's been long enough. Our fight was probably trivial.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then a couple honorable mention members. There's Manny Elias. He played drums. He left in 1986. And then there's Ian Stanley, who played keyboards in the band, and he left in 1987. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like there was any issues with them. They just kind of – I think one of them, I think Elias left because they were trying to – they were kind of going a different thing than he wanted to play maybe. Yep. Stanley just kind of – I think he was kind of done with Roland, maybe.
Yes. I think Roland is the lightning rod for a lot of the creative dissolutions that mm-hmm. in the band seems he's a bit of a control freak, I think.
Yeah. Cause that's what kind of drove the breakup, not quote unquote breakup, I guess, is because Roland kind of became a control freak. He was kind of a perfectionist on the recording of their third album. The Seeds of Love. Yeah. And so I think it just kind of drove a wedge between these guys that knew each other since they were teenagers, essentially. So I think I could see that though. If like you're doing this touring thing, you get really big, and then like all of a sudden it's just kind of the personalities are kind of coming out with the fame maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, I don't, it's not working out.
And I know there was, I forget the name of it right off the bat, but Roland ended up building a home studio because he had quoted that like when he's making an album, he's at the studio for like a ridiculous amount of time.
Yeah.
And Kurt Smith liked to like party and things. Uh-huh. So I think that was kind of some friction making records too, is not always around together.
Yeah.
But he did at least for, you know, the first several albums, all the writing is going to be Roland.
Mm-hmm.
But Stanley is a big part of the writing. He liked writing with all of the keyboardists that came in. I think they were a big part
with
of,
like, craft the musical identity of each album or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then later, I think Kurt brings in a writer he was using for his solo stuff. I think for the sixth and seventh album, he was a part of that.
Yep.
But yeah, as I mentioned, so they met as teenagers. They played in a band called Graduate. It only had one release. They were around for 3 years.
Some ska influence on that one, the two-tone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even listen. I didn't go listen to it. That's interesting. So after Graduate ended, they were session musicians for a band called Neon. That's where they met Manny Elias. And then also the other members of Neon actually went on to become the band Naked Eyes, which they had a big hit in the 80s. It's like always something there to remind me.
The Burt Bacharach cover.
Is that a Burt Bacharach cover? Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. So yeah, if you listen, if you're not familiar, if you don't recognize the name Naked Eyes, look up that song and you'll be like, oh yeah, okay, I've heard this on the radio at some point.
Yeah, I think they had like three or four that ended up being decent American charters at the time.
Yeah, but that's the one I remember. That's the only one I knew at least. Mm-hmm. And then so basically then after that, they kind of came together to form Tears of Fears, essentially. I think the biggest driver for them was, I guess, two things. One, they wanted to go with a synth pop type sound from being impressed by hearing Our Friends Electric by the Tubeway Army, which is Gary Numan's first band. And then it kind of, that synth pop sound got reinforced by hearing OMD, Depeche Mode, and the Human League, which are all big British synth pop bands. Like right before, it's like right around the same era, honestly. Like if they formed in 81, Depeche Mode had two albums out at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. OMD was maybe about the same. So like they were just very tapped into that British synth pop kind of sound from the get go.
Yep.
And then I guess the intent too. So I know we mentioned, you know, four members of the band. I think they were the key members for the first two recordings at least. And Stanley was around for the third, but the intent was essentially, it was just gonna be a duo because of OMD was a duo. Soft Cell was a duo. And they wanted to basically have them as the nucleus and then have kind of a rotating cast of outside musicians come in to help kind of finish the product sort of thing. Which kind of comes, that's kind of happens later, I think. Cause like, even you notice on like the second album, Songs in the Big Chair, the album artwork, I think is just them on the front. I think on the actual vinyl, the other members are there. If you have the gatefold, you could see them, I think, but they're clearly the front and center too. Right. So, kind of interesting that, that was kind of the intent all along. I know it's one of those things, like, it's not like it started as a core four and then they're like, no, this isn't working. We're just going to two. Like they wanted it to be two.
Yeah.
And just kind of go from there.
So even I know we saw them together concert for the Tipping Point, but even I like stage presence in the stage shows, that's clear too. The two of them kind of jammed together there at the front. And then you have the other musicians around doing their thing.
Yeah. Let's see. And then I guess how they, we didn't mention how they met Ian Stanley. So they basically met him early on because he offered them free use of his 8-track recording for early demos and he kind of got looped in from there. Talked about the breakup a little bit, the perfectionist, the jet setting lifestyle. And I guess the big thing too, they also had issues with their manager, Paul King. That was a big thing. The manager ended up declaring bankruptcy in 1990 and he got convicted of fraud in 2004.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So they had some issues with him. I don't know if they were like super adversely affected financially by him, but it seems like he might have been kind of skimming. I don't think he was like their only band either. He might have been doing it to other people.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then, got back together in 2000. Due to legal matters, they kind of reconnected, started working on a new album together. And then Yeah, I think so. The more recent album was, so 2004 was the first release when they got back together. And then 2013, they basically started working on the latest effort, which didn't come out till 2022. So we'll get into that thing later. And the one thing I didn't notice either, or didn't know, was they did some covers of like modern indie bands in that meantime. I don't know. Did you listen to them at all?
No, I had not known that until like looking at this. So yeah. I didn't in the lead up to this.
Yeah. I listened to them a little bit. They're fine. I was thinking like some of them could work with just like, oh, Tears of Fear spin, but like, I think the Arcade Fire one's maybe the best of the three. So they had Arcade Fire, Ready to Start, Animal Collective, My Girls, and then Hot Chip, Boy from School.
Yeah, there's some interesting choices that I would agree. Looking at those, it sounds like that could do something interesting with them. But that's also, too, I mean, we've talked about starting as the synth pop, and I think anyone that's not super familiar with them, heard of Tears for Fears, you're going to think of them pretty heavily connected with the Depeche Modes and Human League things.
Yeah.
But they evolved pretty quickly from that like standard of music to adding more like guitar pop and.
Yeah. And we were kind of talking about this off mic, like when I was kind of going through the listens and stuff, like I got my order down pretty after a couple rounds of listening, but I'd had a hard time getting into, I guess, specifics about each album to kind of really drive home my points of why I like it. And it was one of the things, like, I do enjoy this band a lot. It's one of those things, like, sure, I was familiar with the singles up front and casually a fan of, like, the second album at the time. And then it's one of those, I don't know, something about, like, the pandemic. I think just, like, something clicked with this band to have a desire to, like, see them for some reason. It's like when they announced the new album, they had the tour, and, like, this, all right, this has to happen. But yeah, it's just like a weird obsession, but not really. Like I wasn't like, oh my God, like I'm just talking about Tears of Fears constantly. I don't know what it was exactly, but so you'll tell when I start talking about these albums and I'm like, like I like it. I don't know what else to say. Like, just like listen to it, guys.
And there's this one. And that I think so this was the one, speaking of like it being that pandemic and across it, it was just that night we were like went through the YouTube rabbit hole while sharing beers videos, and stuff or something. Yeah. And it was, I forget if it was like, was it a BBC Sessions or something, but it was just Roland and Kurt like hanging out. This was a like small For Your Eyes Only set or something that they're doing. It was just awesome.
Yeah. I do remember that. My girlfriend gave me a hard time with that one because it's usually the one like the go-to because it's on like the YouTube history for a while. So it's easy to access. I'm like, yeah, let's watch this. And then like I'd fall asleep within 10 minutes. And she'd be like, nah, I'm so sick of Tears of Fears. But what else? I guess the other thing worth mentioning, I think, just a general note. So the name of the band, Tears of Fears. So they were originally called History of Headaches, which if they kept that name, it's fine.
It's kind of dumb.
Yeah, it is dumb. but Tears for Fears, I guess, was inspired by something called Primal Therapy, which was developed by Arthur Janov, which I guess Primal Therapy is a trauma-based therapy. I didn't read into it too much, but this Janov guy was, I guess, kind of popular. He was Lennon's psychologist in the 70s. And then I guess the band met him in the mid 80s, but then they became like disenchanted with this dude because this guy, it was like all Hollywood and shit. He's like, oh, like you should like write like a musical about me and all this stuff. It's like, whoa, okay, time out, man. So he seemed like an interesting dude, this Arthur Janov guy. I don't know.
Yeah. I think a lot of those techniques are still like relevant and used. So it was he started out kind of legit and
got to his head. Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. So the Janov stuff comes into play early in their albums. Yeah, what else? I don't know. I know you mentioned we saw them. That was what, three, four, five? Oh, no, that was.
It'd be
2 years ago.
22.
It was after I left Passion. It was after I left my old job before I started the new job.
Okay.
It was the same day I left Passion. So, yeah, it was 2022.
It was right after that. It was only a month or two after the album came out, I think.
Something like that.
Because they were kind of touring as it.
Yeah.
Was released.
But that it did live up to my expectations for sure. I thought they crushed it.
Yeah, they had like the video visuals and everything they had the whole time.
I was more disappointed that we had like, it was at Tinley Park for us. That's an amphitheater out here in the Chicagoland area. So like if you don't, you can get seats and depending on where you're at, you can kind of get a shitty spot to look at or you're in the lawn, which is like decent if you wanted to just go for cheap kind of thing, but you can't see as much. We kind of got like back, we're like middle, but we were kind of like towards the back of the seats-ish. Mm-hmm. We used to like see the stage fine. But like I just remember like everyone around us like would sit for the songs they didn't know. And we just stood the whole time. So we like had the debate of like, do we sit? And we're like, fuck no. Like we enjoyed this. We're standing up. No one complained at least, but it was still just like, you're out here for Tears. All right, yeah, you're going to get up for Everybody Wants to Rule the World. But like, sure, mm-hmm. but this new album ruled.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, this is interesting subset of people around us for sure.
Yeah.
I think we had the one group that like came down from the lawn and tried to take some seats or something and got moved out.
Yeah, there was something goofy. Like someone was sitting in our seats too at some point, weren't they?
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Yeah. And they were like, oh yeah. And they just like shifted over because like we had some space in our row, but at first I'm like, oh God, I'm gonna deal with these people. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I think they were like, oh, there's seats right there. Why is like they're ticketed. I don't want to have to deal with it later. These are our seats.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm just here. It didn't ruin the experience.
And it's not like we had like where they had to shift wasn't like a hugely different vantage point either. It was literally still within the same viewport of the stage. Mm-hmm. So it didn't change anything. It was weird. Yeah. They were ready to like make a big deal about this. I'm like, you're clearly not supposed to be here. So move. yeah. But I think I'm good on their history. Is there anything that we might have missed?
No, we pretty much got everything covered that I had to talk about.
Okay, cool. So we will take a break and we will come back and discuss the discography of Tears for Fears. All right, everyone, welcome back from the break. Seven albums for Tears for Fears, starting with The Hurting in 1983, followed by Songs from the Big Chair in 1985, The Seeds of Love in 1989, Elemental in 1993, Raul and the Kings of Spain in 1995, Everybody Loves a Happy Ending in 2004, and then finally The Tipping Point in 2022.
But hopefully not finally.
Yes, we shall see. I don't know, with how the last one went for them, maybe they don't care as much, but we'll see. starting with 1983's The Hurting, it's my first note for this, in bold, concept album alert. It has been a while since we've done, I guess maybe not too long. I guess there was one for The Clash this season, right? I think one of those was a concept.
I think they might have been.
Was it Sandinista? S1.
Yeah.
Something like that. But it's been a while since we've had like a full-on concept album. So I guess this is one where the loose concept is based on child abuse, psychological trauma, and depression. Roland was going through some shit, basically.
Bold choice. Let's see how that works out for him.
Got yeah, it. Right? I mean, the album art's just like a child in the fetal position, kind of crouched with his face covered by his hands and stuff. Mm.
So, yeah, I think that Suffer the Children single came out before the album was being put together, and that was the artwork for the single, and then they just kind of co-opted it for the album.
Sure. It works, I guess, with the name, too, having The Hurting and having a child look like that on the cover. So on this album, Roland and Kurt worked in close collaboration with two producers, Chris Hughes and Ross Collum. And I guess it was like a very democratic process. They all kind of – they only used ideas they all agreed upon, mm-hmm. which is funny how that's how it started. And then it goes to Roland going full control kind of thing. I think the biggest song from this is probably Mad World. That's the one I was most familiar with before getting the album a few years ago, mainly because it got covered for Donnie Darko by Michael Andrews and Gary Jules. It's a pretty good cover. I enjoy that cover.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
But I guess originally, too, Mad World was supposed to be a B-side, and they included it, so they made the right choice there to put it in.
I think that especially for our generation and younger, the first Tears for Fears you heard – was probably the Gary Jules Mad World cover.
Yeah.
It was like the big song for the Gears of War gaming franchise too.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, the initial trailer for that had that plan. It was cool. That game was real fun. So yeah. I got hooked on it then.
Yeah. So it has like a very dark vibe on this album. I know some contemporary reviews gave them some flack for trying to be Joy Division. I don't get it. Maybe I could see of the time, like, oh, it's this weird. I was like purposely listening to this album on the drive over here to record. And it's just like, I guess I could see what they're saying. I think it's something with the bass sound. I can maybe see what they're thinking with Joy Division, but I was like, having listened to Joy Division a lot, I'm like, no, I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, like the darker themes of depression and things, maybe because of Ian Curtis's nihilistic lyrics and his deeper intonation, but it'd all be superficial. Beyond that, I don't think it really sounds like Joy Division at all either.
No, to me, this is more like, it's the Depeche Mode dark vibe, but it's not like their full dark vibe Depeche Mode. This is like the tweener stage of like Construction Time Again Depeche Mode.
I was going to say, yeah.
But it's like better than that, in my opinion.
A little not true industrial, but there's this and then sort of into the next one have that industrial undertone.
I know exactly what you're talking about. There's the certain sounds that just like resonate. You're like, ah, yes, this sound. Because there's definitely, I should have wrote it down for the next album. We'll get into it, but there's a sound in the next one of the songs, the next album, that sounds like the level Frigate on Goldeneye. It's one of those things, we can get into that later, but it's something about that. So I'm like, oh, this is definitely taken, that like when I hear the song, I'm like, this is definitely lifted for the Goldeneye track, but I haven't been able to confirm it. But anyway, yeah. So this is kind of their first foray, something dark, which is up my alley. I enjoy that. You know, overall, I would have never known this is like a concept album without looking up the history, you know, the stuff about this album. I never would have pieced it together.
After knowing that, it makes sense really listening to the lyrics and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's not overt either. Does a decent job of, it's like Pale Shelter, I would have just assumed was like a breakup song or spurned love type of thing or something. Mm-hmm. But that's one of my like favorite underrated songs.
Yeah, I did enjoy the Hurting also in this one. It's like that first, the first three songs, I think pretty good run to start the album, I would say, from my point of view. But in general, pretty good. I don't have too many notes on this album, to be honest. Like, again, we're already going to get in early where I'm just like, oh, I don't like, it's hard to describe. For me, it's just hard to describe this band because it's not just a straight synth pop, new wave, whatever. Like you said earlier, like they start adding different elements and layers to different things. I mean, as a whole, yes, it is this just general, like, yeah, sure, it's like alt rock, radio rock, or whatever, synth pop kind of thing. But I don't know, it just feels like there's more to it that's hard to kind of explain for me.
Obviously the darker, it's more of an inward pointing sound too. It feels like you can kind of hear the walls that they built for this album that they wanted to kind of confine in with the structure a little bit. But yeah, I mean, overall, very strong debut.
Yeah, definitely agree. I think I'm good on my end. Are there any points that you wanted to bring up? Or
no, I think, yeah, they're only thing I had, like, the vocals on this one too can feel a bit clunky and like overly groomed for some of the songs, especially like Suffer the Children. I felt like they were going for a very specific vocal song that wasn't really fitting for either of them, that they get away from pretty quickly. But yeah, otherwise I think go for it.
So for me, I have this at 3. Good first effort for the band. It has that dark vibe that I enjoy, so that's why it's a little higher of the 7 for me. But I think with the concept album and like some of the, like you said, I think you put it best with like having the walls, how they kind of sound. Mm-hmm. I think they become more free in the later albums. So it kind of helps open up the door for them a little more. Yeah. So,
yeah, I'm pretty close. I've got this at 2. Okay. It's, I do like more of the earlier where they're, still kind of more electro focused, mm-hmm. To some of the later stuff. And just, you know, having Mad World, Pale Shelter, Ideas as Opiates that I've listened to quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's pretty well. And the interesting thing, this is a very heavily hip hop sampled album.
Really?
As well. Memories Fade was reworked by Kanye on 808s and Heartbreaks for Coldest Winter. Mm. Weekend sampled Pale Shelter for Secrets on the Starboy album. Hmm. And Drake sampled Ideas as Opiates for Lust for Life on the So Far Gone mixtape, which was unexpected.
Yeah, definitely did not expect that. So it's kind of up there with like Tom Tom Club territory with the one song that gets sampled by everybody. Mm-hmm. all right, so we'll move on to 1985. Songs from the Big Chair. So for this one, I guess it was originally titled The Working Hour, which is a song title on the record. But they ended up changing it based off a 1976 American television film, Sybil, about a woman with multiple personality disorder who feels safe when sitting in her analyst's big chair. Mm-hmm. This goes like, they were very into psychology, it seems like, because the Janov stuff was all the first record, and then this kind of something else, something, you know, it's a movie, but involved in psychology kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Which it's kind of like their big screw you to the critics and everything, too.
Both. Yeah.
I know the big chair was also their, the theme from that TV show of them, like, being safe in their space from being attacked by the British music critics and everything that have to go back to being lambasted for being Joy Division late.
Yeah.
And then that goes to the album artwork again. It's just the two of them kind of like giving that smug
face. So honestly, for this, the best summary of like my feeling on this was, in a Pitchfork review for this record, they noted, so the main foursome would go in the studio from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. 5 days a week, and they started experimenting with individual fragments and then building them out. They took their time and loosened up their approach, and more importantly, they enjoyed themselves. And I feel like that's very, like, you kind of hear it in this record more than the last record.
Yeah.
Because this is like, it's a 41, 42-minute record, but like it goes by so fast, I feel like. You could just like blink and it's done, I feel like. Even though this has like all the biggest hits, right? It's got Everybody Wants to Rule the World, Shout, Head Over Heels, like all the songs everybody knows. There's no turning back. They're like, I don't know if it's just the way they organized it. Like even the slower songs still kind of, it doesn't slow down the record. If
yeah.
That makes sense. Right. So it's eight songs too, which is nice. It's really easy to get through. But yeah, having all the big hits, really launched them in kind of the stratosphere too with this one.
I'd agree. Which interesting enough, I mean, it's the next one, a mixed, but it was kind of the opposite to Seeds of Love with me, and going back and looking, I was like, well, they're both eight, they're both similar lengths and they have songs that are length as well. But this, like you said, this one like doesn't feel long. You're enjoying it as everyone doesn't get stale.
Yeah. I made the comment on talking about the last album with that song that sounds like the Frigate level on GoldenEye for N64. I wish I made a note of what it was. I want to say it's Broken. There's like some part of the snip of Broken, I think, like that guitar breakdown that goes like dent dent. There's some, we're gonna have to listen to this off recording, but I think there's something about that.
So I know, and I think very weird coincidental tangent. Mm-hmm. Something recently, I guess there's been a thing of people trying to figure out what made what instrument was used to make like the GoldenEye theme song to play.
Oh, really?
And someone ended up finding it. It ends up being some like weird simple instrument. Not a kazoo, but something like that that just like is pitched down a ton. It's like, okay, I don't know who came up with that.
But interesting. Well, good job, whoever did.
Yeah, maybe that. Maybe they used the same instrument in songs.
Yeah, I don't know. And then I think the other thing from the Pitchfork article that stood out to me, not article, review, I think you kind of made the point about the critics and stuff is after the first record, Kurt and Roland had they kind of had the ambition necessary to produce an era-defining album. And that's basically what this one was, right?
Yep.
They felt like they had something to prove to both their critics and themselves. And I think like that summarizes it, that and just they enjoyed themselves in the recording process. Like that just like blew the doors wide open for this record and just made it what it is, I think.
They go from kind of, you get the feeling they were maybe a little apprehensive or unsure of themselves in the first one, and now they got that monkey off their back and now they're just out there playing for free.
Yeah. I know I mentioned like all the big hits on this one. I think you got to like Mary Fuck Kill the top three. I don't know. It's, I think like I lean towards, I feel like everybody likes Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I lean towards Shout maybe a little bit, I think.
I would lean towards Shout as well. I think Head Over Heels is the sleeper of the three.
I would agree. I'd agree with that. I'm lost in admiration. Dude, I need you this much. Oh, you're wasting my time. You're just wasting time. Something happens and I'm head over heels. I never find out.
But that's also Kurt Smith's only writing credit, I think, until they get back together, which I was surprised. I always thought that they were more of a like creative duo.
Yes.
In sound.
Yes.
It does sound like you said the first one was kind of collaborative. So I think Kurt probably did come in and help put his spin on things. Mm-hmm. And everything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to see that is mostly Roland doing the heavy lifting.
And the weird thing too, I guess obviously there's the break in the middle without Kurt, but like this is, you can kind of tell in the first record who's singing this one. It's harder to tell sometimes who's actually the lead at times. Mm-hmm. And it's like my Wolf Parade problem when I first heard them is I couldn't tell. I didn't realize there was two different vocalists in Wolf Parade. And then, so this one, like you kind of, sometimes when you get to the records without Kurt, I'm like, oh, this sounds a lot like Kurt. I'm like, oh no, it's Roland singing. I think I'm like, what the fuck? So it's a little goofy. So it's kind of hard to tell sometimes who's singing what, but,
It's one of them too, as these albums, obviously from the 80s, synth pop, some of those synth pop bands feel dated and of the era. Mm-hmm. This record doesn't feel overly like, oh yeah, that's an 80s one. I'm listening to it for the nostalgia and stuff. It's got a sound that still holds up.
Yeah, and it's gonna be 40 years old next year, which is wild. Like it holds up very well. I don't have too much more to say. It'd be your spot to rank, so you can kind of, if you want to, I'll throw it to you for any final points that you can go into your ranking on this one.
I think that was one of the bigger points I had there. With Shout, they do a continuation of the darker industrial vibes of the first album before they do open it up a bit more. And then they start to move to like the guitar forward pop work and adding the different instrumentation. You get some of the sax, especially the Working Hour, featured pretty heavily. other than that, I think this is a great example of how to expand and develop a core sound from one album to the next with keeping your identity, but mm-hmm. being able to change it around.
Yeah.
This is one I'm pretty confident in saying we're going to match at number one.
Yep.
And yep. probably won't be too divisive with anyone.
No. I'm not getting anything else at. I think that summarizes it perfectly. I have it as one as well. So we'll move on to The Seeds of Love, 1989. So this is where the issues maybe start coming up. So it took them 4 years to follow up The Seeds of Love. I'm sure that's part, I mean, in the 80s, people were still like, even if a record got big and they were touring, they were still finding a way to like pump out a record pretty quick, right? To like capitalize, yeah. like it took them 4 years. And apparently it cost them over £1 million to make this record compared to the previous one, which is like a fraction of that, right? This, again, yeah. Roland spending a ton of time in the studio, trying to perfect everything.
Bringing in like crazy unnecessary session musicians like Phil Collins drums on Woman in Chains, I think.
Yeah. So this is the last record with Ian Stanley as part of the band. It's just like very uncommon, I feel like, in that age of music to like take this long to capitalize on your popularity and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So, but also too, I think part of it, maybe why it took so long. So they had a recording session in 1986, apparently, but both Roland and Kurt were unhappy with it. So they scrapped it completely.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. I wonder what happened with that. But the fact it was like still at that point, all right, we both agree, let's not push this out. So let's, you know, mm-hmm. put it to the side.
And then they do have that 2020 Super Deluxe Edition too that I think has a lot of most of those recordings are on that because it's a 4-disc like 50-track deluxe edition and stuff. That's insane.
Yeah. So kind of what was driving? I guess so. Here's where the kind of the device. So I guess Roland was becoming very tired of program pop sound. Which, like, I didn't feel like their last one was like a program pop. Maybe it's one of the things of the time they thought that about the record versus like us listening to it almost 40 years later. We're like, not at all. What am I even talking about? But he wanted something more organic, not coming from sequencers and machines. Like, totally get that, right? You want to play more live instrumentation on the record. Sure. Mm-hmm. Maybe go about it a different, slightly different way. But
yeah, I think it's one of those he still had the seeds of the critics from the first album in the back of his mind. Maybe. Like, I want to shoot everybody.
Yeah. For this one too, I think the big shout out for this one, Oletta Adams, the backing vocalist they brought in. She's on a couple tracks. The biggest one is Woman in Chains. Most mm-hmm. people are going to be familiar with for her. I think she shows up on.
She does
just that one.
One and two, and then backing vocals in.
Oh yeah, Badman's Song.
Woman in Chains, Badman's Song, and Standing on the Corner of the Third World. Mm-hmm. But Woman in Chains is the one where she's heavily up front.
Yes, that's a great song. Even Badman's Song too, I thought was pretty good. I think it's a little underrated. My go-to is this was Sowing the Seeds of Love. That's their big poppy single from it, I think. That also had a weird, like, I Am the Walrus beginning. I don't know if you caught that.
They tend more and more Beatles as their career goes on.
Yeah.
So I noticed that on a few different things.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, you just, the opening beat, you're like, huh? What? This isn't the Beatles. Mm-hmm. But it has like this, it's a different sound than the previous record, but it has, is kind of a jazzy sound. I don't know. There's something about it that sounds like jazzy. It sounds big. It sounds. Mm-hmm. They're getting out there more with this one.
Yeah, I think
Sister Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds.
jazz and disco kind of become a thread for them.
Yeah.
Following this album. I mean, not like the in your face 70s on the floor dancing disco.
Sure. Kind of stuff,
but, it definitely, feels like a Roland Vanity Project album to me.
Kinda. Yeah, I see that.
Cause it was, Raul, was it? The
Kings of Spain.
Raul and the Kings of Spain was originally floated for the title to this album. Mm. And Roland has Spanish heritage. His name was going to be Raul, and then his parents anglicized,
yeah,
they made it Roland.
Yeah, yeah.
he did name his son Raul thing, but I think that puts he has a lot of himself as part of this band.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what else for this one. Yeah. It's definitely, again, they've like kind of like adapted, maybe not adapted. They have changed their sound up a little bit.
There were some like hints of like Michael Bolton ballady stuff on this too that threw me off.
Yeah.
I personally had Year of the Knife as my favorite.
I had that down. That was like my other sleeper song was that one. It's like this upbeat, almost like gospel-y type chorus in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was a really good one. A lot of long songs in this one, too. That one's 7 minutes. Bad Man Song is 8 minutes. But I feel like it doesn't drag, though, for some reason. Like, it didn't feel like it dragged. I guess it is a little longer than Songs of the Big Chair, but...
I think this is their most divisive album. Mm-hmm. You like it. Or you don't, depending on how you feel about things. Like Bad Man Song was one for me that like I felt like just kept going. I was listening to it and come back and say, been listening to this album for like 20. It's only on track
still
two.
Still Bad Man Song, yeah. I'm sure that there could have been some editing maybe done to help bring it down a little bit, make it like a tight, closer to 40 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Make some of these songs closer to 5 minutes and it still works the same. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have too much more else to say on this one.
No,
go for it. All right. So for me, I have this at 4. I still enjoy it enough. It has a unique, different sound than the first couple records. It's a little out there compared to some of the other stuff, I think. Mm-hmm. But I got enjoyment out of it. I think it still has strong song, like the songs we talked about, I think are still very strong compared to some of the other work that's coming. So,
This was like going through initially, immediately put in that 6 to 7 range a little bit. It just after the first two, this one, there was some where it just felt like it was for a specific reason, trying to put that feeler out there more than just to make good music.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly doesn't commit the sin of being boring, which my actual number 7 does a little bit when we get there. But so it did move up from the bottom as I came back to it. I listened to this one the most of all of them, trying to rate it, and ended up settling on number 5.
Okay. All right. So we'll move on to 1993's Elemental. We are at the halfway point here. So this is the first... air quotes, Tears for Fears record. That the hardcore fans, some people like to disregard this era without Kurt. I think it's funny, like it's a solo Roland thing, and this is where it's hard to tell, like this album, the next album, it's hard to tell sometimes because on Cold on this record. Me, I don't long to be long.
Communicated, 'cause I
very much sounds like Kurt is singing. And I think they he had a guy in there to do backing vocals. And it's like, oh, he's trying to just replicate Kurt just with this other guy.
Yeah.
So like, it still seems like he wants, he needs it, right? He needs that extra voice.
So is Julian Orzabal doing backup vocals there? So I'm guessing that's his brother related to him somehow.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of interesting that he still kind of replicates Kurt's presence in that sense. But I feel like he's also getting petty with his, what's going on here. There's the breakup with Kurt. So diss track kind of quote unquote with, Fish Out of Water and even Break It Down Again. Mm-hmm. And then I guess Cold is kind of a diss track on Paul King. Cause it was the line King got caught with his fingers in the till. Where's your calculator? Will you leave it in your will?
Yeah.
So he was airing some grievances, I think, on this record a little bit.
It is, and I'm usually the opinion, if you're going to like lose major players or carry on and keep the name of a band, the like keeping one of the major songwriters and then like a vocalist are big and where.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's still Roland being part of it. It does lose some of that collaboration element, everything. But it's still, especially since they were able to reconcile and Kurt comes back.
Yeah,
helps. Whereas, like, yeah, this still counts as Tears for Fears.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with this one though is kind of like there's not a real through line on this record. They kind of jump around a little bit. I feel like with what's going on, the sound, but it still kind of works. Like there's that Brian Wilson says, which is a weird, it's got the Beach Boys vibes cut. But then there's like a little bit of that smooth R&B groove type thing on Mr. Pessimist. I don't like, it's just this, there's kind of, but there's like also the, like the straightforward, like rockish sound of like Break It Down Again. Hey, to the crowd. Has my favorite lyric of Moses on a motorbike in that one. So I did enjoy that when it was played at the concert when we saw him.
It's, yeah. And this is the one too, where I had, you get that smooth jazz pop. And between this, so we talked, I mentioned, Big Chair doesn't sound dated at all. I think both Elemental and Raoul are very clearly 90s outputs.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Because it's not like he was trying to replicate like grunge or something. It just feels like 90s radio.
Yeah, there's like,
trying to keep it going.
The sound of that era, different things that these two, especially Raoul, like fall into very heavily.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like, I know I kind of talked about him kind of airing his grievances. He had a public quote where he was basically downplaying the loss of Kurt, where he said, "The relationship I had with Kurt was like that of a producer to an artist. I'd help him get his vocals right and even help write his songs for him. It wasn't really a shared thing." It's like, damn, dude. You're taking this well.
Yeah, that's the jilted lover vibes. It's like, oh, I never really cared about you all that much. I'm good to move on.
But you did. Let's be honest, Roland.
Because Kurt did his own diss track on his solo solo album after this too. Later on they I know Kurt later on laughed about it. He's like, yeah, Fish Out of Water is pretty funny.
It's nice they could have a sense of humor about it now all these years later, but yeah, I don't know, like this one I think ultimately is okay. It's, you know, I think you could pull some songs out of it that you might like to enjoy, but to me, without kind of a through line like some of the other records had, it seemed hard to enjoy it fully.
I agree. From here on, that kind of meandering style and things are pretty much what they do. They don't hit a specific tone, I think. So that didn't bother me as much as it probably would otherwise if it was like this one album that they I guess at this point. Although he did, Alan, so third keyboardist, comes in on this one, yeah. and he continues his writing with the keyboardist, so Alan Griffiths. And then Tim Palmer is on this one, too, as producer. And this was right after he worked on Tin Machine, which was Bowie's band, when non-solo. And then he also mixed Pearl Jam's 10 just before this. So that might be where they start getting that like heavy 90s sound.
Yeah.
With the guitar work and everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was a step back from the somewhat pretentiousness I felt was coming through on Seeds of Love.
Okay.
So maybe he's like, okay, yeah. And I write something that's not, even though it does have the diss tracks and things, it wasn't like trying to be overly cerebral or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I'll throw it to you. You can go to your ranking after that if you want. So,
but yeah, it's one I like coming back more to, kind of having that prog pop be sound again. Establishment, because it's one could have easily derailed the band's legacy with the breakup coming out with the first solo album. Mm-hmm. But ends up doing a good job. I actually have this one set at 4.
Okay. Yeah, I'm right by you. I have this at 5. I think just the highs of Seeds of Love just beat it out for me, even though these are two different type of sounding records. And just honestly, that Moses on a Motorbike line, Break It Down Again, I just really enjoy it. So I did write down, I got it wrong first. I wrote down Jesus on a Motorbike. And then I was like, listen, I'm like, oh shit, I gotta get it right.
Gonna get all the hate mail again.
I know, right? Sorry, Jesus. Next album, 1995's Raul and the Kings of Spain. So this is the last, quote-unquote, Tears for Fears band record. It's the same group of contributors as Elemental, so Tim Palmer, Alan Griffiths are all involved. He does reconnect with Oletta Adams on this one with Me and My Big Ideas, which I think was an enjoyable track. But it's caught between night and day. You're stuck between me and my big ideas. Won't wash away your tears. So many strings to your. Just having that. Oletta's has got like such, you know, it's a contrasting voice compared to, like, Roland has a unique voice for himself, but she has this like big, you know, she's a big type of voice compared to what he has.
Yeah. Right? She's got like that opera projection.
Yeah. So that was kind of a nice, add, for this record. But I think you kind of touched on it with the last one. Like, it has this 90s rock vibe. This does have, it doesn't jump around as much as Elemental, but then because of that, it just doesn't jump off the page in a sense. Right.
So this is the one that, is the kind of boring one to me that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting stuff here and there, but yeah, it's very dated. Like you could peg that it's got that 90s pastiche all over it.
Yeah.
He starts to kind of delve into a little bit of the almost folky Americana guitar rock a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
The fun one, Queen of Compromise, sounded like it could have been one of Seal's main tracks to pair with Kiss from a Rose.
I have to go back and listen to that then with that in mind. That's kind of funny. There are way too many flies. I'm the queen of compromise. She'll never know the act she's selling. She could turn me out the size. Cause there's something under eyes. And it might just... Yeah, I think critically, it didn't do well. But I feel like Roland kind of relaxed a bit on this one, too. Maybe because he didn't try anything weird on it.
I wrote down, like, the grandiosity of some tracks he's had on the last two. He kind of continues to take that slope down into just more of a serene sound.
Yeah, I'd say he slows things down a bit on this record for however that works out. And there was one, I didn't note which song I should have, again, my great note-taking. But I said some of the vocal pitching slash changes were a bit weird. I can't remember which song I was thinking of when I wrote this down, but anyway, take that note with what you will. Yeah. Oh, I remember what it was. I think it was Da Raul, or was it Raul? It might have been Raul and the Kings of Spain.
I think you're right.
I think there's that weird at the end of the song kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got Los Reyes Católicos in the middle, which is more of just the instrumental one, and then closes with a reprise of that that mm-hmm. expands on it a little bit, which is...
I do like fine. How there's notes in the wiki about mislabels on the CDs for two of the tracks.
That's happened multiple times for them
too. Oh, really?
So, but that's the interesting one is they switched everything prior to this was on Mercury. They switched to Epic for this one.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the weird year before promotional CD released on Mercury Records. And then there's the actual 1995 Sony Epic release.
I gotcha.
Which is...
That's the what's one on Spotify. That's the one there on is an extra track, that's
the,
right?
Yeah. The promotional one is where things were mislabeled. I don't know why it was released on their previous label. And then I didn't really find anything on that, but it seemed kind of weird.
Now I'm doing a quick check. So I think, let's see, sorry. Oh, there's no Queens of Compromise on the Sony release? No, there was, right? It's listing it, Queens of Compromise is not
no,
it, track.
Yeah. They added Humdrum and Humble.
Uh-huh.
And
I Choose You is the
yep.
Don't Drink the Water, Made My Big Ideas. What the hell? Hold on, I'm going to do a check on the phone real fast here. Because I thought Queens of Compromise was a track on the...
I did.
Live checking everybody.
There is, if you listen on Spotify, they have multiple...
Oh yeah, it's Humdrum and Humble on the...
Okay, that's I did... Listen to Queen of Compromise because okay. It is on there. Again,
there is an expanded version.
Yeah, if you're not paying attention, they have multiple different releases for each of their albums that different things.
My bone of contention with Spotify and what they do, but
I also don't like how I prefer the phone GUI to the web app or whatever browser for looking at albums and things.
So, yeah. All right, we're getting sidetracked here. That's as much to say about this record, I guess. I don't have much else to say, I guess. Do you have any final, or I can do ranking. Yeah. You can make your final points on yours.
Yeah. Is it back?
Cause it's seven.
One, two, yeah.
Yeah. This is five. Mm-hmm. So I have this at six. I don't hate it. Like it's not the best effort. It does have that 90s pastiche on it, like you said, but I don't mind that too much, I guess. I kind of like it, so in that sense. But out of the context of Tears for Fears, I think it falls to six for me. Like, it's fine. There's nothing great about it. Nothing stands out, but, like, it's fine.
Yeah, pretty similar vein. It's seven. This is the one I could just discard.
Mm-hmm.
Don't need to come back to.
Yeah.
I had a couple of the tracks where I think I had God's Mistake, Sorry, and Don't Drink the Water on this one. But otherwise, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. All right. So we'll go on to 2004's Everybody Loves a Happy Ending. Kurt's back, baby. So first album, 9 years, just for Tears for Fears in general, and then the first with Kurt. So this was the album they started working back on in 2000 when they reconnected basically, but then got slated for release in 2003, label management changes. They got dropped by Arista, or no, they broke ties with Arista.
Yep.
Cause I think the person who signed them left, or something like that.
Correct.
But luckily they own the copyright to the record, so they didn't have to re-record anything, which is great. Oh, so they could take it wherever they needed to go. Shopped it around. I think they ended up on
New Door,
which I'm sure is a
I think it's a Warner Brothers imprint.
Universal.
Yeah.
Well, I think Warner Brothers maybe got whatever. I can't track that anymore.
I think now it's Warner Brothers Universal or something. But.
But yeah, this one, like, I think with Kurt back in the fold, it seems like they're still working things out musically, even though I know Roland's the main driver. Mm-hmm. I feel like this does have some sounds of what the future, what the more recent album sounds like. Sounds of Sorrow kind of has the vibes of The Tipping Point. Are your thoughts for these days? Don't steal, just borrow. But then there's like, then it has like a little bit of modern rock radio with Quiet Ones. I don't know. Again, this is like, I didn't find like anything overly interesting about this record. It's kind of their, they got back together, so they're still kind of working it out. And my biggest thing, my biggest gripe on this record is I actively dislike this album artwork. It is.
It's very busy.
I do not like it.
Yeah. Especially, it's like some old, it's like a GeoCities website.
Yes, yes. That's a good way of putting it. It is aggressively bad.
And Smith comes in and they are collaborative on the writing for like 85% of this one too.
Yeah, and they get this Charlton Pettis guy. He was Smith's writer pal, I think, that he was using in his solo record. So he sticks around for this one and the next record. As a contributor.
So yeah, I think to your point, it is kind of a feel it back out album. It was the hype of Smith coming back.
Yeah.
I think you do hear that slight change when you get the collaboration of the two of them that adds to their music. But I don't know, yeah, it seemed kind of very vibey of just Kurt and Roland cherishing being back together and jamming for a lot of it. But this had the biggest shift away from the new wavy roots so far to me, I think.
Yeah.
And I really got that British Invasion influence here. So this is where I thought it had the biggest Beatles-esque pop tinge to it.
Okay. Yeah, I think with this one too, like, this is of an era where, like, I think no one was thinking about Tears for Fears, and this record probably just, like, snuck out. And I'm sure, like, all the hardcore fans, like, oh, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
But, like, we were, what, 2004, so, like, sixth grade? No, just kidding.
No.
High school. Sophomore year of high school. Oof.
We're old.
Like, I'm not listening to Tears for Fears in 2004, really. So, but yeah, I don't know. I don't have a lot to say. I didn't find this album super interesting, so. That's kind of where I'm at with it.
Yeah. So not the most artistically boundary pushing, but it's comforting like a warm blanket on a cool night.
Okay.
It's the end of the season, man.
Just throw them out, see what sticks. It's you for ranking, Phil. So you give your final points here.
I did like, Closest Thing to Heaven and Call Me Mellow were a nice back-to-back track there. Call Me Mellow, The Laws, There She Goes, I thought it sounded very similar to that, like, want to do the higher pitch upbeat poppy sound.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting, but it's nice. I liked having them back. It elevates it just above Raoul for me and sits at 6.
Okay. Yeah, this one's 7. I liked Raoul a little more, I think, with the 90s pastiche on it. So this one falls to 7. All right, so yeah, we are at the last album, 2022's The Tipping Point. 18-year fucking gap since the release. Holy shit. So this one, yeah, they just kind of ran into a litany of issues, I think, to get this out. So let's even get this timeline right. They started recording this back all the way in 2013. Then they had numerous delays and setbacks that basically caused the gap of 9 years, basically, to get it out. They had disagreement with their management company. So they were asked by their then management company to collaborate with various younger artists in an attempt to create a more contemporary and commercial sounding album. those sessions sucked. So they found it like it was speed dating and they did not enjoy it at all. Then Roland's wife passed. And then I think Kurt thought about leaving the band at the time. Like it just didn't, they were just like not, it just like wasn't going well. But then they did a tour in 2019 and I guess it kind of like brought him back to life. Like, all right, we could do this. We could bring this to the finish line. So the bulk of the album was completed in 2020 and 2021. Obviously that's pandemic era. So I think you kind of slow down. Yeah. You slow down the process then and just kind of get it done when it's ready. But then I think once they left I didn't get the name of the previous management company that did the speed dating with the younger artists, but Universal showed interest and they released a greatest hits to help pave the way for the new record. And then they delayed the release too. So I think it eventually came out on Concord.
Yes.
So that is an imprint by anybody we know.
No, I think it's its own small independent.
Yeah. So, but I'm glad I got out, to get a tour out of it so I could see them. And this is one, like, I feel like this had no business being as good as it is. Being 18 years since the previous record, Tears of Fears isn't even in, like, the mindset of people. This is like the Hum record, the new Hum record that got surprise dropped in 2020. It's like, haven't heard from this band in forever. This album should not be this good. Same thing with this one. It kind of recaptures that early 80s magic, but it has like a more modern touch to it, obviously, because it's been, you know, 35 years. Even like the ballad type songs work. I think like a consistent female backing vocals kind of helps too on a lot of these. Yeah, this is a great kind of a comeback in a sense, but because it was 18 years.
I'd say this is like comeback with an exclamation point for me. This is how you do a comeback, especially not like the current with artists of, this is our final show we're picking up. Yeah. And then a year later, hey guys, we got a new album. Yeah, we're touring. Yeah. Okay, just say you're going on like a hiatus. Yeah. Still call it the end of the band.
Yeah, yeah. Like this one, I think the tipping point is kind of like the big radio rock type song that's out there for them, which is good. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed, I think, like Rivers of Mercy, I thought was really solid. You get Kurt singing lead, like this ballady type thing.
My Demons, right before that, I liked a lot too, those two. Really, the only one that really didn't hit was kind of Break the Man, was a drawback.
Yeah.
That one gets kind of disco-esque again. It wasn't terrible. It just, I don't know, it was a weird one on here compared to everything else.
Yeah. They got some momentum back behind them. So hopefully, if they're thinking about another one, it won't be 18 years in between. Otherwise, I don't think they have that much time in them. Yeah. But this is just a really, really good record.
I think you hit it where it does a good job of staying true to what their sound was that they'd be recognized for while feeling modern.
Yes. Yeah. I guess I can make the final. I mean, if people, no one, I always say like, oh, you're keeping track at home. No one's keeping track at home where we have these. I have this at 2. I think like it just has no business being this good, but like it just has that, like we've already hammered it home. Mm-hmm. It's recapturing the magic. I think it's an awesome comeback record for them.
We're not going to match exactly, but I agree. It's number 3 for me.
Yeah.
It hits up right there with their debut album, their early stuff.
Yeah. So that's it for Tears of Fears, guys, and season 4 in a sense. Well, I guess we'll get to that later, but rankings, we'll kind of recap here, going from 7 to 1. 7, I have Everybody Loves a Happy Ending.
Raul and the Kings of Spain.
And then at six, I have Raul and the Kings of Spain.
And I've got Everybody Loves a Happy Ending.
And at five, I have Elemental.
I have The Seeds of Love.
So you know what I realize? We're flip-flopping everything except for one.
Yep.
at four, I have The Seeds of Love.
All right, I've got Elemental.
Three, I have The Hurting.
I've got The Tipping Point.
And then two, I have The Tipping Point. And I've got, and then one, Songs in the Big Chair.
So yeah, as you can see, there are definitely tiers of their albums.
Tears and Tears
like.
For Fears. Hey, still got it, baby.
And then depending on which sound you like, maybe you're maybe you're me, maybe you're Mike.
Yep. Band Rex, for this one, Simple Minds, kind of an 80s contemporary for them to some extent. Not to an extent as a contemporary, but to an extent of the sound, I guess. They're UK-based as well, so it kind of helps.
Yeah, Simple Minds goes more bright electro-poppy, most of their stuff. But
yeah. And then Spandau Ballet, purely for the song True, because I don't know where I heard True. I'm like, oh, this is a Tears of Fear song. Like, what album is this on? Like, I wanted to find out. And I kept Googling it, and I kept coming up with Spandau. I'm like, no, that's wrong. It's Tears for Fears. Like, I was just convinced it was Roland singing it. And it was like, oh, no. And then I realized, like, oh, okay.
I could see that.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
So that's all I had for Rex. Okay. I don't know what you had, but.
Yeah, similar vein to Simple Minds would be Duran Duran and Men at Work. I think Genesis is an interesting one. It's another kind of more contemporary. I know Peter Gabriel was a big influence for them that they noted on. Obviously, he's one of the big duo of Genesis with Phil Collins.
Yeah.
Then the other two that interesting, Police and ELO.
Okay.
Again, it's there's like intersections on some points and then they get far off. So it kind of depends on which album and era you pick for any of the recommendations, I think, that we made.
Yeah. But yeah, so if Tears of Fears is coming around, I don't think they have announced another small leg of the Tipping Point tour at this point. So who knows what will be next for them. But go see them if you get a chance. If you're remotely a fan and you haven't seen them yet, I would highly recommend it. Yeah, the best opening line was, I think, what he starts like, "Welcome to the wizarding world of Tears of Fears." I'm like, yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah, because Roland's just out there with his long white hair.
Yeah, yeah. Plugs? Any plugs? This comes out first week of March?
Summer!
Yeah, I wrote Hackus.
Nice.
Have a kick-ass summer, everybody. We're signing yearbooks.
Yeah, coming earlier and earlier, thanks to all of our global warming.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. I mean, I guess I'll take advantage of it now until the world goes to shit.
Doesn't help my anxiety. But.
Yeah, I guess we're on socials. Obviously, we're probably going to go dark for a while once we have our summer break. Facebook index, Instagram index _ pod, email index podcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, I guess we haven't really planned out or talked about what's next. We do have
the list of mini episodes keeps growing. Catch up. Yeah, we should probably catch up on that.
We've got Vampire Weekend now, finally just got announced.
Yeah, so that just added to the list. So we got a few of those to knock out. We'll probably figure out a season 5. I think we could figure it out. Worst case, my goal is to get to 50. So
that may a nice round number.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll
figure out a different
planning a little more ahead of time and give ourselves some.
Yeah, this year felt like a struggle to try and get the recording sessions done.
Wanting to keep the cadence, I think we waited too long because we've kept right around Halloween.
Yeah.
We'll try to debut, so maybe we'll keep that, give ourselves a little more time so we're not as burnt out by the end.
But we're doing it for you guys. We love you. We love our fans, all 10 of you.
Do yourselves a hand.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks for listening to season 4. Index will be back Halloweenish. Keep an eye out for the teaser. If you got any suggestions, let us know.
All right. We are looking for a new label. We want to switch things up like the bands we cover.
So. Let us know if anyone's signing us. HeadGum, get at us.
Until next time.
Bye.
Tears for Fears has now been in.